the creator and the maker of life and the giver of our lives and the one to whom we all owe glory and honor for our existence. And whenever we can come together to praise him collectively, and of course we need to do so also individually, that's one of the greatest activities that we can engage ourselves in, is letting him know how much we appreciate everything that he has done for us, is doing for us, as we go through each and every day. You know, last evening we talked about the subject of how we need to bump our life off of its present center. And what we mean by that is that one of the impacts that sin has had upon us is the fact that sin causes us to be very selfishly motivated. That is, whenever we look at our lives, we usually ask, what's this going to do for me? And we start to develop this kind of mindset where we think that life is really all about us. And so we begin to look at our income and finances as being about us. We look at our spouses and our marriages as being about us. How can my wife serve me? We think about our children from the standpoint of we want them to be what we want them to be. And we even do that religiously as well. And so what we saw last night, that life is not meant to be selfishly motivated. That's not what your life is about. We, in the very beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth and made mankind, made us to be God-centered. It's sin that has caused us to not have that God-centeredness that we all need. And we have that me-centered approach to life. And so we have to get firmly entrenched in our minds that if we're going to live our lives, we have to live them to the glory of God if we want to make heaven our home, and if we really want to be able to enjoy life here on this earth in the way that God intended for us to do so. You know, once somebody asked the question, said, well, if life is to be all about God, then isn't God on some kind of ego trip? Well, no, he's not. In fact, you've got to keep in mind that it is best for us that we make our lives all about him. See, there's the point that we've got to realize, that our life is best lived when it's all about him. That is best for us. God is never selfish. He's never egotistical in that sense. But yet at the same time, because of his greatness, because of his holiness, because of his nature, because of his eternality, because of all of the attributes that he has, which makes him God, behooves us then to make our lives all about him, which in turn then gives us the kind of life that's filled with joy and peace and wonderful life here on earth, that's independent of circumstances, that's independent of the happenings that go on in our lives day by day. Now, as we mentioned last night, we sometimes look at that and we say, well, we understand then what the goal is, but how do we reach that goal? And many times, I guess that's one of the places where we as preachers often fail. We often tell people what they need to do, but we don't tell them how to do it. And so we looked at the shift that Moses had in his thinking as he beheld the glory of God. And you know, that's what we have to do. If you remember when Moses, and for those of you who were not here, we'll kind of recap what we mentioned. When Moses was called by God in the burning bush to go to Egypt, if you remember, his conversation with God at that point was all about, who am I that I should go? Who am I that they will listen to me? What am I going to say? Who is it that sends me to you? And finally he says, I am not an eloquent speaker. And then he reaches the conclusion, you need to send somebody else, not me. But all throughout his conversation with God, it was about me, 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 I, who am I, how am I, and all those kinds of questions that self-centered folks often ask. And we do the same thing. But as we mentioned, he got down in Egypt, and he beheld the glory and the power of the Lord. As God then began to work and move marvelously among the Egyptians, and he saw the day turn to night, and he saw the river turn to blood, and he saw all of the plagues that descended upon Egypt. Moses witnessed all of that. So by the time we get to the point to where they've now gone through the Red Sea, they're on the other side, God had given Moses the charge, I want you to take them now into the Promised Land. Notice that Moses experienced a shift in the way that he thought. he was saying, who am I? How am I? And now it was, are you going to go with us? Okay, he had finally figured it out. It's not me. Doesn't matter who I am. Doesn't matter how you're going to do it. The point is, are you going with me? Is your presence going with us? Because Moses said, if your presence isn't going with me, then I'd just soon not go. Leave us here to die. And if God, of course, told him, my presence will go before you. And Moses said, show me your glory. And you know, that's the mindset that we've got to have in life. As we face all of the various aspects of our life, whatever that they might be, the good and the bad, all the happenings that occur, we have got to develop the mindset that it's not about us, it's about God. And whenever we view life from that perspective, then even those things that are difficult, sometimes even tragic, take on a different light. Doesn't mean they're less painful, but they have different meaning now when we look at it and say, you know, maybe what's occurred is best, we know it is, and that it's about me having an opportunity now in this circumstance to show God's glory. Because you see, we're like the moon is to the sun. That's the way we are with respect to God. We're to reflect the glory of God in our lives by the things that we do, the things we say, where we go and where we won't go, and the life that we live. And as we face those things that we face in life, it's all about glorifying God. Whatever we do, we need to glorify Him. But there's something that often gets in the way, and that's that meanness. Not meanness, well, that does too. But all about me, the I concept. Because you see, we're prideful creatures. Whenever you stop and you think about the subject of pride, what you're thinking about is that exaggerated sense of one's own self and self-importance. That's what pride really is. That's what it's all about. It's an I-centered approach to life, where everything centers around me, revolves around me. I'm the center of my universe, and everything in it, it should be ordered, we think, to take care of me. And really, I'm the one that matters. And so, you know, when things don't go my way, then I get upset, and I become haughty, and I become all the different ways that people do. And you know, God has told us all throughout the Bible, warned us about the deceitfulness of pride. He's told us how that we need to avoid pride and that we have to get rid of it, and we have to replace it with a meek and humble spirit. You know, shortly thereafter, as we look at the life of Moses, God was able to say he's one of the most humble men upon the face of the earth at that time, the most humble man on the face of the earth at that time. And the reason that that was the case, if you remember, Miriam, Moses' sister, her pride had gotten in the way. You remember what happened with her? You know, Moses had appointed 70 elders. Now, Miriam and Aaron had kind of been Moses' right and left hand, so to speak. They were there. They shared in the discussions that Moses had, and he shared with them what he was going to do. Then all of a sudden, he appointed 70, and Miriam was not one of those 70 elders. So what she did was like any good prideful person ought to do, was to make up a reason why Moses shouldn't be the leader. And she started talking about his wife. And it's kind of interesting. She complained because of who it was that Moses had married. And that really wasn't. And have you ever noticed that when people are usually mad, what they present to you is not what they're really mad about to start with? Okay? What they're really mad about is somewhere down in there, buried somewhere in there, and you've got to bring it out. We ought not to have to do that, but we do. And most of the reason why we have to do that is because what they present to you, they know is so stupid and foolish, they ought not to say it, you know, and they're mad. So they've got to make up something to try to give some validity to what it is that they're doing. So she started complaining about Moses' wife. And the reason I know it wasn't her that was really the problem was the very next verse in that chapter in Leviticus, she says, you know, has God not also spoken by me? You know, has God not also dealt with me? Just like he has Moses. So it's really a prideful thing. And if you remember, God said to them, he said, Aaron, Moses, and Miriam, come out of the camp. Wow. That'd be kind of scary, wouldn't it? Can you imagine God saying, hey, you three, I want to see you now, out here. Okay? And so out they go. And then he looks at them and he says, Miriam and Aaron, come forward. I got something I got to say to you. And he starts off his conversation by telling them about Moses. And more or less, he says, you see this man? Yeah. You know, I can imagine how they must have been at that time. Yeah, I see that man. You know, he said, I've always had people I've spoke to and revealed my truth to. And he said, you know, I've spoken dark sayings. I've spoken prophetic images and in dreams. He said, but not so with my servant Moses. I have spoke to him face to face because he was the most humble man on the face of the earth. You see, it's humility that makes us irresistible to God. I worked up a series at home that I entitled Irresistible to God, a study of pride and humility. And it all began when I began to look at some of the folks in the Bible and I asked the question. You know, most of the time we need to understand it's more important to ask the right questions many times it is than to know the answers. Because I tell you what, you may think you know the answer, but if you don't have the right question, your answer is not going to help you any at all. And I remember looking back and I see the Davids and the Solomons and the Moseses and Peter and Paul and all these guys and ladies in the Bible that God was so close with that he used. And I used to think, you know, God just must have arbitrarily picked them. You know, all right, let's look on the face. Well, there's a guy named Abraham. Hey, come here, Abraham. I'm going to do some great things through you. Or there's David. I'll just use him. Or maybe they were super spiritual folks, right? They just had something I didn't have. Well, they probably did. Okay? And as I asked the question, what was it? And I began to look. It wasn't their educational level. It wasn't some of them were shepherds, fishermen, kings. It wasn't their economic level. You know what it was? They all possessed humility. That's all it takes. That's the key to God's heart. But to be humble, we got to deal with pride. And pride is hard. It doesn't like to go. You know why it's so hard? Because it's so deceitful. That is, that we can be proud and not even know it. Now, we see it in others very quickly, but we don't see it in ourselves. And you know, a lot of the things that happen to us, a lot of the circumstances which you and I face that we often think are painful, ought to be lessons to us that we should humble ourselves before Almighty God. But like deceit does, we don't. We just continue on becoming more and more prideful and never really enjoy the blessings of brokenness. But you know, brokenness is where it's all got to start. Because when you look over in the book of Matthew chapter 5 and Jesus begins to give us the discourse on what we call the Beatitudes or the blessings, you know, I used to read that and I thought, this is all those different groups of people that make up a church. So you got your meek people, you got your mourning people, you know, you got this kind of people, the hunger and thirst after righteous kind of people. And finally one day I got to looking and I thought, you know, I better be like every one of them things. You know, and then all of a sudden I looked at it from a different angle. No, I don't think these are different groups of folks. I think these are qualities of all of God's people that we better have. You remember what that one starts with? Blessed are the what? Poor in spirit. What does that mean? People who realize their poverty. People who have been stripped of pride and have replaced that pride with the true image of self. So you see, in order to be pleasing to God, we must be humble. And to be humble means we've got to deal with our pride. And pride takes many, many forms. Whenever you begin to look at pride, it does. You know, here's what happens. And the one we're going to talk about tonight is the most heinous of all forms of pride. And that is religious pride, spiritual pride, the worst kind. But you know, it does take many forms. Because what happens is we as Christians often, when we hear the word pride, we think about thinking of ourselves more, you know, better than somebody else. And so most of us say, you know, I really don't think I'm better than anybody else, so that lesson on pride wasn't to me. But that's just one form of pride. There's fearful pride. Do you ever notice over in the book of Revelation when John was quoting Jesus about those who would be cast into the lake of fire, do you remember that he mentions the unbelieving and the who? The fearful. people who are so paralyzed with fear that they won't take the action that they know to take and take control of their life and place it in the control of God's Holy Spirit, because they're fearful, afraid of what might happen. And you know why they're afraid? Because they're prideful. They're afraid of failing, maybe. They're afraid of the unknown. They want the security. It's self-preservation. Then there's the hedge you in or hedge you out pride. You run into those people who are always mean and snappy, and you know what they're really doing is trying to keep you at bay. Why? Because they don't want to take a hurt. And their pride is, don't get too close, because if I get too close, you could hurt me. So pride takes many different forms, just as it takes the form of spiritual pride. And spiritual or religious pride is a terrible, heinous form of pride. In fact, I'm going to make a statement. While you and I understand that we live in perilous times, and churches are not growing with leaps and bounds, I think all of us can agree to that. Most all of us understand that. We are content to start to attribute all kinds of different reasons why that doesn't happen. We live in a me-centered society, and people are not spiritual-minded, and all those things. And, you know, there's the television, the entertainment industry, and all those things that steal people's hearts away from God. Keeps us from being interested. I agree. But I want to add to that list. Many times, we're as big a stumbling block to the lost as anything else. You agree? One of the reasons why they're not growing, we're not growing, why we're not reaching the world is what we're talking about here tonight. Because let me tell you what's happened. We send one of two messages. And all of it goes back to spiritual pride. We communicate to the world one of two things. Depends on how smart they are when they look at us. Okay? Either we are communicating to them, some people actually believe this, that we have somehow overcame, have no temptations, have no problems. We are super spiritual. We never wrestle with anything. And you know, they're sitting back there just honest enough to say, I can't ever be like that. There's no sense me trying to go to church. You know, they're honest enough about themselves and what they have to face that they say, you know, I failed quite a bit. But see, we've got them duped. We make them think that we don't fail, right? We don't mess up. You never get angry at somebody without a cause, do you? Your temper never gets the best of you. You haven't gossiped lately, have you? You don't think anything bad, do you? A lot of people look at us, and that's what we communicate to them, and that's what they think we've done. We've so overcome sin that we're already, just like Jesus. We're 100% conformed to His image. And so they look at us and say, we're not there. I don't know. I don't think I can get there. Or they look at us and they know us. They say, yeah, that's what they say. You know, but I work with them. I've been in their home. I know what they say. I know how they act. I've heard them talk. And they ain't a thing to them. Because, you see, we're saying one thing, but we're doing another. And people stumble over that. One of the biggest obstacles to evangelism today is the church. The church itself. Because, you see, we have not communicated well to people what it is that we are, which are sinners saved by the grace of God and our obedience of faith to the gospel. But we don't communicate that to them. What we do is we communicate to them that we are better than them, and that we have reached it, and we doubt that they can ever be where we are. Maybe if they try real, real hard, they can be as good as Sam is. right? You know, that's the message we send, isn't it? You know, some of you know, and I've told this story in a couple of places. I don't know if all of you have heard it, but you know, we have the church at Duke Street, a little small congregation. Anywhere from 15 to 25, okay, on Sunday morning. Resulted as the work of our television program. Because the message that we preach, for some reason, through the television program, we seem to appeal to people who don't know much about God. I mean, they actually... So, don't tell me people don't care. They do. We're just not getting it to them in the right way. And you know, so the television program been on for a few years, and one day this phone, and I always end my program with saying, you know, if anyone would like to study with us, we'll be glad to set up an appointment and we'll study with you. Phone rings. Lady picked up the phone. She said, "That's a preacher on TV." I said, "Mm-hmm." And she said, "You said you'd study with anybody. Will you really?" I said, "Yes, I sure will." "Where do you live?" "Oh, you mean you're coming to my house?" Okay, you know, I mean, wow, there's a lot of wackos out there. You know what I just told them? Come on over. So I go back and I tell Marlana, "Don't leave." Okay. Stay in the back and out of sight and keep your hand on 911. You never know what might happen. Right? So while I'm sitting there waiting, you know, and this car pulls up. I'm peeking out the blinds, you know, all right, who's come? This woman comes out of the car. All right? Big woman. Hot pants, halter top, flip-flop, cigarette about that long. Tattoos. Down both arms. And I thought, "Lord, what are you sending?" And then I felt ashamed. There's that religious pride. See, we want to preach to what? Good people. Well, good people don't know they need anything. Right? Give me the nice middle class folk who has a job, who doesn't need anything, and you know, that's who we want to be here, right? Not ladies in hot pants and halter tops and flip-flops with cigarettes and tattoos. Where are we going to set them? Right? And so she came in. And she said, "If I were to die today," this was her first statement. She said, "I'm going to hell." And she said, "I know nothing about Jesus." Wow. So over a period of time, several months, I present the gospel to her. Then one day she comes in and she said, "I want to ask you something." I said, "What?" She said, "Where does a lady like me go to church?" Now, I knew what she meant. But I didn't want to say I knew what she meant. So I said, "What do you mean?" You know, you ever done that? You know, I mean, "What do you mean, a lady like you?" She said, "Don't give me that. Look at me." I said, "Yeah." I said, "I understand." She said, "I tried going down here," and she pointed a couple of buildings in there. And she said, "You know, you'd have thought I had the plague." And I said, "Well, you're welcome to go with us. We drive 45, 50 miles away, you know, every Sunday." And she said, "My car won't make it." And she said, "I got to get back in time to work at a place, you know, in the afternoon." I said, "I don't know. Let me think about it." So I started a congregation. I rented a storefront and then called a family that I knew that would come and help me. And I told her, I said, "You know where people like you can go to church?" She said, "Where?" I said, "Right over there, Duke Street." And that's how we got started. We've had alcoholics. We've had people who abuse drugs, and we've even had homosexuals who have changed. I remember one Sunday there was a fellow there that got up and he was waiting on the table. I'd baptized him, shaved head, an earring, okay? Billfold with a chain that hung to his knees, prayed the most beautiful prayers he waited on the Lord's table. You know how hard it was for me to say, take that earring out of your ear. You know, that was what I was trying to do. That's what I wanted to do. But I tried to exercise patience. Because when you seen where he came from, hey, an earring wasn't a problem. You see what I'm saying? But why is it that those folks don't feel comfortable here? Isn't that who we're supposed to be reaching? The establishment didn't hear Jesus very gladly either. They killed him. But who listened to him? Who heard him gladly? The poor, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, the people who really knew where they were spiritually. But you see, we have a tendency, because of that pride, even when we come to Christ, to turn it all back on us again. You remember over in Revelation chapter 2, the church at Ephesus? The church that left its first love, right? I remember years ago when I taught on the church at Ephesus, or the book of Revelation, and it say they left their first love. Now, I'll show you what we've done, because I did the same thing they did. What is the first love? You know what we automatically think of? The things we do for Christ. That's our first love. Is that what our first love really is? Or is our first love supposed to be Christ himself? And the things we do for Christ flow from that love for him. Oh. See, when we first obey the gospel, what happens is we fall in love with Christ because Christ saves us from our sins. But then, before long, we flip it all around to where what we do for him takes precedence even over him. You know, when you look at that chapter and you honestly evaluate it, the passage on the church at Ephesus, he didn't get on them for things they had been doing and stopped. He talked about things they'd done well, things they were still doing well, but he still had something against them. They didn't know he had something against them. I mean, they were trying those who were false apostles and finding them to be false and kicking them. They were standing for the truth. They were persevering. They were standing strong. It wasn't that they had been and had stopped. They were. Right? So you can imagine when he was telling all that, they're sitting there thinking, boy, we're doing a great job. He said, nevertheless, I have somewhat against you. You've left your first love. What? What do you mean I left my first love? I am going here and doing this, doing that, doing this, doing that. When the first love is supposed to be Christ. Husbands, we know what this is like, don't we? Think back when you fell in love with your wife. Think of the things you did. Roses, dinner. Why? Because you loved her. Somewhere along the way, we still give them roses and dinner. Why? Because we got to, right? They're going to get mad if we don't. You see what I'm saying? Same thing, different reason. And we confuse what we do with who we love. I was taught that this winter. Marlana's birthday's in January. Nobody ought to have a birthday close to Christmas, right? You got to buy them two sets of gifts. Okay, January 3rd. And her birthday was in January. And we had been going through a box of stuff prior to that, and I found, you know, she found the old love letters I wrote. I can't believe I wrote this. Where'd that guy go? You know, I mean, that was what she was asking. Okay, and then where'd he go? Well, I had to look at her and say, well, I don't know. He ain't here. You know, something's happened to him. But some of those things I said, you know, I turned red when I read them. And I found in there a little card that I had given her on her birthday. And it was like 12 months of our relationship. I think I took her out her first time on her birthday. And I had sent her 12 roses, and I wrote some poetical thing about, you know, one rose for each month of this first year. And then it dawned on me, it's birthday time again. What can I do? I hadn't planned on it. So I went to the office and told my secretary, call, order a dozen roses, you got to send them to Marlana. Okay? Now, the roses was the same, but my motive was different. See what I'm saying? That's what the church in Ephesus did. Because, see, pride takes us back to where we start emphasizing doing the right things more than for the right reasons. And that's what we as a church have got to beware of. Religious pride has been a problem among God's people in every dispensation of time. Because what happens is, we start developing, because of the blessings, because of the promises, a holier-than-thou attitude, which is the obstacle to saving lost folks. Those who are possessing spiritual pride see themselves as spiritual giants, and they begin to start judging everyone around them. Hey, it's easy for us, here in the church, people who study, pray, come to the assembly, to look out at the world, down our noses at them, and say, I'm better than they are. Right? I guarantee you, I could load all us up in here. We could go down to the state penitentiary. We could walk through, look at the rapists, look at the murderers, look at all those folks, and walk out patting ourselves on the back, thinking about how good we are. But we're measuring ourselves by the wrong standard. First Corinthians 10, you remember what the Apostle Paul said? Let's just turn over there and look at what he said. Because this is what we do, and this is why we have so much trouble. And what we have forgotten. 2 Corinthians 10, I'm sorry. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 12. For we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. But they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise. Yeah, relatively speaking, we better than those in prison. But let's measure ourselves by the true spiritual yardstick, Jesus Christ. Oh. Okay, so I lack. Yeah, you lack. Yeah, I lack. Yeah, I'm not much better when you look that way as those down there. You see what I'm saying? Measure yourself by the proper standard. When you measure yourself by the standard, the image of Christ, and see how far you lack in being conformed to that image, then you cannot have pride in anything you do. We even sit around and talk about how we hope we're doing enough to get there. That's a prideful statement. Hope I'm doing enough. Oh, you can do enough? What is enough? What balances that out? Oh, well, I'll go to church enough to make heaven my home, right? That'll cancel the debt. I'll study enough. I'll preach enough sermons. I'll pray plenty enough. That'll get me there. Will it? Well, if it would, why'd Christ die? Why didn't he just tell us pray more? Go to church more. Read the Bible more. You see, we're prideful creatures, so we think about what it is that I got to do enough of to get there. Hope I'm doing enough. And that's where everybody else is supposed to say, oh, you are. You know. That's where we tell each other that and compare ourselves among ourselves, pat ourselves on the back by ourselves, and hey, the world's dying and going to hell all around us. We're headed there with them. Well, we've deceived ourselves into thinking we're not. Blinded by pride. Wow. Spiritual pride becomes religious pride. It manifests itself in that. And we know that that's what we're suffering from when we do, as I just said, we begin to think in terms of despising those who are in sin. And it's not those who are in sin we despise. We despise the sin they're in. There is a difference. Despising the person who is in the sin means that you wouldn't save them, throw them a lifeline, do anything to help them at all. So we sit in our nice, comfortable buildings that are cool in the summer and heated in the winter. We sing about how we love Jesus. And every now and then we might peek out the door to see what the lost folks are in. And we say, well, we've set it up. If they want to come, let them come. And then when they come, we look at them like, what are they going to do, hold us up? See? No wonder we ain't growing. This lesson stings, don't it? I didn't like it when I wrote it. Okay? I remember I debated 4 or 5 times on the way to church the first time I was going to preach it, whether I ought to or not. But I did. About 4 or 5 times now that I have. Because we ain't going to get any better. That's what we're told. When you're spiritually proud, you become, to us, religion becomes a ritual. That's another sign. Gotta go to church tonight. Or, do I gotta go to church tonight? You know, whichever way. We don't want to do any more rituals than we got to, do we? You know. But when you're religiously proud, you go through motions. And in fact, those motions become more important than the motive behind the motion. So then if somebody doesn't do the right motion at the right time, we're going to pounce and make sure they either learn it or get out. Sound familiar? Being religiously proud is motivated by the praise of men. It's what we're looking for. You know, I remember years and years ago, a guy told me, he said, Sam, you're starting to preach. You need to keep you a list of everybody you've ever baptized. I said, why? So you'll know how many you've led to the Lord. Well, I never kept that list. I couldn't tell you. Okay, I couldn't tell you. That sounded bad then. That sounds bad today to me. It's not notches in the belt. That ain't what it is. I ain't led nobody to the Lord. Holy Spirit leads them through the Word. Right? But you know, that was the thing. That's religious pride. You know, I was hearing two preachers one time talking, and one of them was talking about the number of people that was baptized at the meeting he had just been at. He was coming across pretty humble. You know, hey man, 15 people or something like that was baptized. The other preacher looked at him and said, yeah, but I was down there the year before and I got them all ready. Okay, he's going to work himself in there somehow. Somewhat. You know, religiously proud. We become motivated by the praise of men. We want to wear what we have done, the badge out here, so that we can receive the accolades of men. Let me tell you something. People who are motivated by the praise of men will tell you anything when they're up here. If you happen to be against this, then they're against it. But if you change out there in the pulpit, they'll change right along with you. Why? Because they've got to be fed what they need. Religiously proud people put emphasis on appearance. It's the outside in kind of religion. Okay? Where everything needs to be in order, at least from the outside. You know, I had a man who was this is the way it is. Let me tell you something. We do this. We try to change people from the outside in, and you know that's not changing. It's not going to work. There was a man back home, and I made this statement. He got very angry with me in the pulpit because I had made a statement that passing laws don't make people better. You know, we got a drug abuse problem. I tell you what, we ought to pass a law where it's wrong to abuse drugs, right? Oh, we got one of them. Oh, I thought they was going to fix everything. All that does is get them out of our hair and protect us from them being out on the streets. It's not about to change them. We got a law of thou shalt not murder. But the law is for the evildoer and the transgressor. And it's not to change them, because if the laws could change us, then we had a Ten Commandment law. It's pretty good. Didn't change a thing. Why, we had to have the gospel. But anyway, this guy, you know, I mentioned that, and I said, you know, some people want to throw their TVs out. Oh, he had done that, apparently. I didn't know he had. You know, when I was standing at the door, he come in, he says, you don't think you'll throw your TVs out the house? I said, no, I got about five, I think, in every room, just about. It is horrible. And he said, nope, got to get it out. I told him, I said, you know, I think it'd be better not throw the TV out, but change the man who's holding the remote. What do you think? He said, what do you mean? I said, if you was right, you'd know what to turn it off of. See, it's got to be changed inside first before the outside does any good. But when you're religiously proud, you don't do that. You put emphasis on the outside, not really caring about the inside. Look at what Jesus said. Matthew chapter 23. This is what he said to those of his day. In Matthew 23, verse 26, he said, let's back up. Let's even go a little bit further. Let's go to verse 25. He says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and the dish, that the outside of them may also be clean. See what he was saying? All change with God's inside out. And religiously proud people emphasize secondary points of the law. That becomes our rallying cry. Ka-chunk. I was reminded of this a few years ago. I was in another state holding a meeting, and I was visiting with one of the preachers that were there. And we went into Walmart to pick up something, and a young lady was there, probably in her mid-20s, and she said, "Brother so-and-so," she said, I know you've been trying to set up a Bible study with me," because we went by and we were speaking to her. She worked there. And she said, "You know, I've got some time this afternoon. Why don't you?" And they introduced me to her. "Come over and we'll talk." He said, "All right, what time?" She said, 3 o'clock. This is about 12. We run out to his car. He said, "I got to go home and get some stuff." I said, "Okay." You know, we go to his house. He comes out with his briefcase, you know, got all these study guides and things like that. He said, "Now, she's a member of blank denomination." And I said, "Okay." I said, "What are you going to study with her today?" He said, "Why they ought not to have a piano." Now, it's important to know the truth on instrumental music, but let me tell you what, if you ain't Christ, who cares what you believe about a piano? I mean, am I wrong on that? What difference does that matter? And so I kept my mouth shut for as long as I could, which was about 2 minutes. And we were going down the road, and I said, "You think that's a good..." I said, "You know, how are you going to say this to this guy? I mean, he's older than I am. He's more studied than I am." I said, "You think that's a good topic to talk with this lady about?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Don't you think we ought to tell her about becoming a Christian first?" He said, "Well, she thinks she is." I said, "Exactly." I said, "She thinks she is." And I've heard, and I've done that myself, try to get up a talk at work with somebody who's not a Christian, and I start with why we don't have Sunday school. Well, then they think I'm a nut. You know, like, "Wow, these guys are cultish." You know, I don't start with those things. Because what if I convinced them we didn't need Sunday school? That still didn't get them into Christ, did it? Do you see my point? So we went on down the road. I'll tell you how the story ended. He said, "All right, I will." He was mad. Okay. So we go in, we sit down at the table, and she stands, and he said, "Well, I want to start in the book of Acts, and I want to talk about what it means to become a Christian." She said, "I already am." He kicked me under the table. Okay. Whoa, what are you kicking me for? I knew what he was kicking me for. And, you know, because that was exactly what he said she was going to say. And so I spoke up at the kick after I said, "Ow." I said, "Now, kind of like this." I said, yeah, we know that. But I said, "Let's just establish the foundation, then we'll move on." Well, when we got to Acts chapter 2, and he read Acts 2:38, she stopped him. She said, "Read that again." He said, "Repent and be baptized, every one of you, for the remission of sin." She said, "Now, we don't teach that that's how you become a Christian." She said, "You make a confession." And she said, "I was baptized several months later." Ah. Click. Door open. You know, we baptized her that day. And if we'd have gone with his plan, all we'd had was a lady who probably would have still believed in a piano anyway, you know, when we got through. But she was baptized 2 hours later. But we have a tendency to do that. I was preaching not far from here, and a church I'd never been at. And we were there, and several people from the community came, some who were not members of the Lord's church. When we got through preaching, I got to noticing one of them looking around, and he went over to the track rack. Now, here's a person who's not a Christian. He goes to the track rack. You know what he saw? Only tracked in the rack was why you ought not to eat in the building. I wanted to go and throw myself in front of the track. No, don't read it. Don't read it. And I could tell he looked at it and thought, don't eat the big one. What's that got to do? And I thought, man, this is all messed up. He didn't come back. Religious pride makes us do that kind of stuff. I remember years ago, I was down in Tennessee. A man had called me down to hold a meeting. And I was holding it. He said, Saturday night, Sam, ain't going to be there tomorrow. I said, why? Can't worship with these folks. I said, well, you call me down here, what'd they do? He said, you'll see. He wouldn't tell me. Well, you know, I thought we was going to sacrifice a baby. I didn't know what we was going to do the next morning. Didn't sleep all that night on Saturday night. Sunday morning, rolled around, I'm sitting there sweating. You know what's going to happen? I preach a message, doesn't happen. Go through the Lord's Supper, nothing happened. I think, okay, whatever they're guilty of, I must be too, because I sure didn't catch it. Well, when it was over, that night he showed back up. He said, did you see it? He called me around the corner of the building. I said, no, I missed it. He said, they didn't break the bread. I said, what? He said, they didn't break the bread. I said, I did too, and pushed prayer up past my face. He said, no. See, what happened at one point, they had two groups serving, so they snapped it in two, and they left it in one because only one man served. Now, that was the claim to fame for this fella. Jesus said, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and ants and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. I'm not saying that things like instrumental music shouldn't be taught on, proper observance of the Lord's Supper shouldn't be taught on, Sunday school's an issue. Let me tell you what, that's not where we start. We need to preach Christ to the world. That's what we do. That's what converts folks. Not issues. We've quit preaching Christ and we preach issues. And what we need to do is to do what Jesus said, go ye therefore into all the world and preach what? The gospel. He that believeth is baptized shall be saved. Then as Matthew 28 says, teaching them to observe all things. We're putting the cart before the horse. But religious pride makes you do that. Why? Because we're proud of them doctrines, aren't we? More proud of them than we are the cross. That's our claim to fame. Right? That's my ticket into heaven. You know, that's what I'm going to present. The way we act. Don't just listen, ain't don't make you feel real good. Jesus said we ought to do it all. But he said there are things more important. And you start where you need to be starting with folks. Listen, religious pride is so dangerous. Let me give you a quick few reasons here. It's dangerous because it reinforces our natural love of self. It's dangerous because it's a reflection of high-mindedness in the worst kind of way. Dangerous because it substitutes a false spirituality for the real thing. It also breeds further deception and delusion for ourselves. And it prevents a person from seeing the need to change. Because when you think you're God's best, then what do you need to change, right? It fosters a fear of man rather than a fear of God. And it magnifies the immediate while it blinds us to the eternal. And that's why it's dangerous. But we as people have a tendency to turn all things back to us again. It's that it's all about me mindset. And that very mindset is what's keeping us from reaching a lost and dying world. It's the preaching of the cross. It's the acceptance of Jesus as the Savior that takes people out of initial sin. Not what they believe about a piano. Not what they believe about the issue of Sunday school. It's about what they understand that they are. They're sinners and Jesus died for them, and here's what they've got to do. Those other things come second after they've been converted. That's our task then. But you see, we've turned it around. And we sit and we wonder, where are they at? They're looking at us and scratching their heads. That's what they're doing. What are they doing? That's where they are. But we have a powerful message. The Bible says that all men have sinned. It's not the lack of hearing the gospel that causes people to be lost. It's sin that causes people to be lost. Jesus came not to condemn the world, for the world was what? Condemned already, wasn't it? And we have found that message of salvation. And that message has been entrusted to us to be taken. And some of the people in the world, they know they're not what they ought to be. They have a sense of having missed the mark. But they don't know what to do about it. And religious pride keeps us from reaching them. But it's the gospel that's the power of God unto salvation. And Jesus died for those folks. He died for the earring tattooed people of the world too. He died for the drug abuser. He died for the rapist. He died for the murderer. He died for the child abuser. I know. You sit here and you think, how could he? Because he loved us that much. And he's where our hope is. Spiritually proud people in the last day will come before God, standing in front of the Christ who saved them. I don't know about you. I plan on coming behind him, you know, peeking around. Because he's the one who's going to get me there, not me. Tonight, if you're not a Christian, we invite you to come by faith, turning from sin, confessing Christ, being buried with him in baptism. Every sin will be forgiven. From there, being raised to be that new creature, which you got to work at, and there'll be many slips, slides, stumbles, and falls. The question is not when you fall, what you're going to do when you do. Okay? That's what's important. It's not an if, it's a when and a what. If as a Christian, you realize that you need some spiritual help, we stand ready to pray with you and for you. That's our lesson, while we stand and while we sing. Thank you.